The Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip has continued, claiming civilian casualties while destroying vital buildings and infrastructure in the Gaza Strip. In this edition of the debate, we will look at whether the Israeli bombing constitutes war crimes or not. We'll also look at how the world condemnation against Israel has reached a level that it may lead it to the unraveling of Israel itself. Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate is Kevin Barrett. He's an author and Middle East expert who joins us from Madison. We also have Daniel Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who joins us from Pittsburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. And Kevin Barrett, let me first start with you. Israel's bombing of the Gaza Strip has destroyed vital infrastructure, including medical facilities, media outlets, and electricity infrastructure. Some of this is required for daily, basically, existence of the Palestinians there in the Gaza Strip. Has Israel committed war crimes?
Absolutely. Israel is the only country that virtually admits to deliberately targeting civilians. That's what they mean when they talk about mowing the lawn every few years and killing a couple thousand more Palestinian civilians. They are utterly shameless in targeting civilian buildings, as the international mainstream media people found out to their chagrin last week when this media building was blown up. Israel claims sometimes that when it's indiscriminately raining down bombs on Gaza, that it's thinking that maybe there are tunnels beneath some of these homes. That's their excuse for just blowing up anybody. But we know from the behavior of the Israeli military in situations like the deliberate sport shooting of children, which is still going on. We just saw more of this in the West Bank just today. A number of children, including a 15-year-old YouTube star, were deliberately murdered by Israeli troops who were a couple of hundred meters away in no danger whatsoever from any rocks or anything. They just killing these kids. Chris Hedges wrote about actually witnessing this many years ago when he was in Palestine. He actually saw the Israeli troops broadcasting out obscene insults on loudspeakers in order to lure Palestinian children out of their homes within range of the guns so the Israeli soldiers could shoot them in the gut for sport. So this is the kind of army we have in Israel, the so-called most moral army in the world, as they call themselves, laughing with duper's delight at the big lies that they spread, as they know very well that they are the most sadistic people in the world who actually enjoy murdering children. So when they bomb Gaza, they're not really thinking that they're going after military targets, and oops, they just happen to kill some civilians or blow up a media building or blow up some ambulances or some hospitals or some United Nations installations and so on. That's what they're doing as a matter of policy, is targeting civilians. That's called terrorism, and Thomas Suarez, in his book State of Terror, exposes how terrorism has been the prime weapon all along in the creation and maintenance of the illegitimate so-called state of Israel.
Okay, well, Daniel Kovalik, what we're seeing unfold right now is pretty much reminiscent of what has occurred in the past wars. At this point, Gaza hospital overwhelmed with the wounded. Gaza city medical workers don't have a certain medical and life-saving medication, for example, to deal with the wounded. And, of course, the number of injured keeps increasing because of the way that the buildings have been destroyed, et cetera. Why hasn't the international community at least provided the humanitarian relief that is quite necessary in order to at least be able to save some of the injured that are flowing into the hospitals, for example?
Well, I think the United States has been a big impediment to any attempts by the United Nations Security Council to address this issue, either with humanitarian aid or with a demand for a ceasefire. Apparently, President Biden has now on three occasions prevented the Security Council from issuing a resolution calling for the Israelis to stop these attacks. Meanwhile, of course, Joe Biden has also approved over $700 billion in emergency assistance for ammunition for the Israelis. That is, apparently the Israelis are running out of ammunition to keep killing people in Gaza, and so Biden's going to make sure they still have that ammunition. So, in short, the answer to your question is the United States. That is the largest impediment to making sure that Israel does the right thing here and that humanitarian aid is provided to the Palestinian people.
Well, Kevin Barrett, I believe that from what our guests there said about the $735 million worth of precision-guided missiles that the U.S. has approved as an emergency, this probably falls under the notion by the U.S. of the right to self-defense, in which, in this case, Israel has that right against the people that it has colonized. You know, we're looking at then grave violations to happen. Is that a green light when you have the right to self-defense to then commit, in some cases, war crimes?
Well, the United States government is complicit in this big lie, among some of the other big lies. They claim that Israel is acting defensively, but that's utterly ridiculous. As we all know, the people who created Israel, who were in fact mostly atheist, ethnically Jewish Zionists who worshipped a kind of collectivist military project to invade the Holy Land, these people were obviously aggressors. They crossed the oceans and the seas to invade somebody else's homeland with the intention of expelling the people who lived there and or murdering them and ethnically cleansing the Holy Land so that they could set up their supremacist state. So that was a quintessential act of aggression. In all of the history of military aggression, there's really never been a more clear-cut case than the Zionist aggression that colonized and ethnically cleansed Palestine. So the problem is that the Zionists themselves are the world's leading experts on being perpetrators and oppressors and pretending to be victims. Just like bullies on schoolyards will grab their victims' little hands and slap their own faces with those little hands and say, "Ha, you attacked me," and then they can horribly beat up their victims. That's what the Zionists have done. They pose as victims when actually they are powerful oppressors. And the United States does the same thing. The United States, before each of its major wars, has set up or orchestrated a false flag attack to justify its war and to make the United States look like the victim. From the Mexican War, in which the U.S. invaded Mexico, started a shoot-up, and then broadcast front-page headlines saying Mexico attacks the United States, to the Remember the Maine incident, in which United States agents blew up their own ship, the USS Maine, and blamed it on Cuba, to the Lusitania incident and the Zimmerman telegram that launched U.S. involvement in World War I, to the orchestrated Pearl Harbor deception, in which the U.S. used an eight-point plan to trick Japan or force Japan into attacking first and make them look like the aggressors in World War II, to the Gulf of Tonkin incident that brought the U.S. into Vietnam, making it look like the Vietnamese had attacked an American ship, to the mother of all false flags, the September 11th event, in which the U.S. and Israel together blew up the Trade Center, murdered 3,000 Americans in order to make it look like radical Muslims and Palestinians were the aggressors. They've been doing this forever. The bullies want their victims to look like aggressors, and they themselves, the bullies, want to look like victims. That's the game. That's the big lie that the Israelis and the U.S. are putting out, but more and more people are starting to see through it.
Well, Daniel Kovalik, you talked about the U.S. and the U.N., I believe, in your last statements in the beginning of that. Why is it that the U.S. has blocked three times now, and it appears that it's going to do it for the fourth time, the adoption of a joint U.N. Security Council statement which calls for a halt to Israeli-Palestinian or the onslaught of Israel's offensive on the Palestinian territories in the Gaza Strip in particular and the protection of civilians?
Well, because the U.S. views Israel as its beachhead in the Middle East. The U.S. supports Israel because it sees it as the one country it can use to exert influence and to project power in the Middle East, and it will do anything to protect Israel's interests, even by supporting Israel's war crimes. And these are war crimes that are being committed in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, where there are pogroms now being committed against Palestinians with the assistance of Israeli security forces. But this is all according to plan. The plan is for Israel to take over all of Palestine and beyond, and the U.S. supports Israel's dream of a greater Israel within the Middle East. But this is not about religion. Truthfully, this is more about whiteness than it is religion. This is the U.S.'s ability to project white supremacy in the Middle East through Israel. And it is a disgrace, and it is heartbreaking.
Well, Kevin Barrett, there seems to be this other narrative, which many are saying, descriptions that involve things like a tectonic shift. This time it's different, as some are saying, about what has happened, especially since there is this momentum behind world condemnation. We see it in the protest that's happening in the masses. And many are saying that this is similar, very, very much like what happened to the apartheid regime in South Africa before it was abolished or before it ceased to exist. Do you see it that way?
Yes, I think that's a good comparison in many ways, actually. Both South Africa and occupied Palestine are settler colonial societies. That is, unlike normal colonialism, which was bad enough, where Britain, France, and other countries moved in and took over countries, stole their resources, exploited their people. The settler colonial societies, like South Africa, Rhodesia, French Algeria, and, of course, occupied Palestine, brought replacement settlers in and expelled the natives. And those societies tended to mistreat the native peoples even worse than the normal colonialists. So there is a very good comparison. And it seems that just as in right around the time that the world changed at the end of the Cold War, there was a mass awakening to the evil of apartheid South Africa. And I'm proud to say I participated in that to some extent. I was in college in the late 70s and the early 80s, and there were big marches and protests against apartheid at that time, and it succeeded in dismantling apartheid. And so today we're seeing a little bit of the same kind of shift here in the United States and across the Western world, and indeed all over the world. But of course, most of the world has supported Palestine, at least morally, forever, but the West hasn't, and the U.S. in particular has been brainwashed by the power of the Zionist lobby. Now, this is a debate show, so I could at least find one thing to disagree with the other guest, who I generally agree with, but I don't think he's correct in saying that the U.S. is supporting Israel because Israel is carrying out American imperial duties and so on and so forth. No, it's actually the other way around. The U.S. is paying tribute to Israel because Zionists dominate the United States, and Israel is a terrific impediment to U.S. imperial success. As Brzezinski accurately wrote, that having to support this state that is utterly loathed in the region has greatly complicated the American imperial project. So I think, in any case, however we want to analyze that, the fact is that the brutal crimes and the extreme racism and the apartheid and the ethnic cleansing and what Professor Francis Boyle has argued is an actual genocide in occupied Palestine, all of this is so morally offensive that just like with apartheid, decent people who open their eyes and see what's going on and see what their government is supporting are becoming increasingly outraged. And that includes decent American Jewish people who are starting to turn against the apartheid entity. So this is all to the good, and I think that Israel's epitaph is being written.
Well, let me address the same question to you, Daniel Kovalik. I mean, I know what you said about the states in terms of its support for Israel and all that. But, you know, we're looking at some Congress women, I should say, that have voiced their disagreements, AOC and also Rashida Tlaib, in which she gave that very touching speech there in Congress. We're looking at world condemnations. We're looking at things that, again, many are saying that this time around is different. Do you think that this is maybe going down the path where the U.S. is going to be maybe one of the sole supporters of Israel? And the whole world, and it's going to be too much, that it may overwhelm the U.S. in terms of how the worldwide condemnation will be in such huge numbers that then the U.S. has to rethink the way that it's supporting Israel, et cetera. Do you think that there's a possibility of that?
I certainly think there's a possibility of that. I think the reason is for the same reason that people erupted in anger over the George Floyd killing and similar killings in the U.S., and that's because of homemade videos on cell phones. You know, the U.S. media has been awful on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but now they have to acknowledge what's happening because people are putting up videos of children being killed, of children under rubble, of civilians in West Bank, in Jerusalem, being subjected to violence by Israeli settlers. This cannot be denied anymore. I do think this is shifting public opinion, there's no doubt. There is a hope, of course, that this will affect U.S. foreign policy, and I pray that it does. I think, though, we have to remember that apartheid in South Africa fell not only because of a shift in world opinion, but also by the outside intervention of the Cuban military with the backing of the Soviet Union, who defeated the South African military in Angola. I don't necessarily see that sort of thing happening here, but I do think that support for Israel in the U.S., the days of that are numbered.
Okay. Well, what has made a difference in some way is the fact that you have rockets in retaliation to the Israeli bombardment to land in Israel, and it has reached towns, including Tel Aviv, Kevin Barrett. Tell us what you think about that and whether that has made a difference, because the reason why I'm addressing this question this way is there's nothing else that has come to rescue not only the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, but also what occurred at the Al-Quds compound, which was the way that Israel brutalized the people who went, the Palestinians who went there who wanted to pray. And, of course, that opens up one of the core issues that exist in this whole crisis or conflict between Israelis and the Palestinians.
Yes, that's a great point. And I would respond what the other guest was saying, in that I think there is actually a parallel between the way that the Cubans, the Soviets, and the guerrillas in southern Africa were a major factor in defeating apartheid, and the way the axis of resistance and the rockets available now to Hamas and especially Hezbollah have changed the strategic equation in the region, in the same way that the Cuban and Soviet interventions changed the strategic equation in southern Africa in preceding the demise of apartheid. I think there is actually a comparison there, because the fact is that the Israelis have been unable to defeat their opponents in recent conflicts. They define defeating their opponents as forcing them to stop firing rockets, and they can't do it. They couldn't defeat Hezbollah in 2006, they haven't been able to defeat Hamas, and they still won't be able to now. And as Hezbollah and Hamas amass bigger and better rockets, and as the Muslim world unites, and some Christians are even waking up and noticing that the Zionist project is horrifically blasphemous and obscene in terms of occupying the Christian and Muslim holy land, the land that's holy in part because the Messiah, the man that both the Christians and Muslims agree is the Messiah, came from that land. And this movement made up of people who despise that Messiah and who have despised God as well, they're mostly atheists now, have taken over this holy land and just rubbed the noses of God-fearing people in the dirt, and had this supremacist project going. This is starting to bring out a religious dimension of this conflict that wasn't there in southern in Africa, and that's a lot of the force. You see, Hamas and Hezbollah are religiously motivated, and that gives them an edge. It makes it harder for them to be infiltrated, and it gives them essentially a metaphysical reason to be willing to die for a good and noble and just and righteous and holy cause. So I think that dimension of the conflict, along with that military equation shifting to favor the axis of resistance, is an important factor that will lead to the demise of apartheid in the Zionist entity in a way that's somewhat parallel to what happened in southern Africa a couple of decades ago.
Final question to you, Daniel Kobalik. We have the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. It has been going on for years now, and it has come out urging renewed economic pressure on Israel. military embargo, boycott of firms that are complicit in Israeli occupation, and it also said the canceling of academic, cultural, and sporting events in addition to that. It sounds great, and it has done what it could, but what about it now, making this call, especially countries who want to adopt a resolution or a statement that can't because of the U.S. at the U.N.? Why don't they put their money where their mouth is and come on board with the BDS request?
Well, I think you will see more and more people and more countries get on board. Again, we do see, again, the comparison to South African apartheid, where you had the disinvestment and divestment movements. I was also part of that in college. And obviously, the BDS movement is taking a page out of that playbook by what it's doing. And I think it is effective, not just economically, but it is an embarrassment to Israel. The entertainers won't go there and perform like they wouldn't go to Sun City and perform. You even have Jewish actors coming out against Israel and saying they won't perform there. And so I think this is putting a huge amount of pressure on Israel, and they are going to come out of this conflict right now with a huge black eye, and they will never be seen the same.
Thank you for that. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it. We're fresh out of time. Daniel Kovalik there, human rights and labor lawyer. Thank you. And also Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert. Thank you for your statements. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikova Tafwa, entire team in the capital of Tehran, is goodbye.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aysel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We've spoken about marriage a few times before, and here when we're talking about relationships with your kin, with your family members, obviously you are going to have to deal with the topic of your spouse. The first part of this discussion is on how you are able to deal with your wife, and the second part is how to deal with your husband. Emphasizing on marriage for women as well, the hadith says, دَخَلَتْ إِمْرَأَةٌ عَلَىٰ أَبِي عَبْدِ اللَّهِ. A woman visited Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq salamullahi alayhi, فَقَالَ أَصْلَحَكَ اللَّهِ إِنِّي إِمْرَأَةٌ مُتَبَتِّلَةٌ. I am an ascetic woman. I want to become a spiritual woman. I want to become a holy woman. I want to become a saint. إِنِّي إِمْرَأَةٌ مُتَبَتِّلَةٌ. فَقَالَ وَمَا التَّبَتُّلْ عِنْدِكِ. What, in your opinion, what does تَبَتُّل mean? She said, لَا أَتَزَوَّجْ, that I don't get married. My understanding of being spiritual, of being religious, is I don't get married. قَالَ وَلِمَا. And then Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, and why is that? And then she said, أَلْتَمِسُ بِذَلِكَ الْفَضْلِ, because I want to gain virtue. I want to become virtuous. I want to get holy and become spiritual in that kind of sense. And then the Imam said to her, انصرفي. One meaning here is go away, but that's not the meaning, that's not the real meaning. انصرفي here means, and even Ayatollah Jawadi Amali mentions this in his Persian translation, it means get rid of this idea, change your perspective. This wrong, your attitude to this is very wrong. In صرفي فلو كان ذلك فضلا لكانت فاطمة سلام الله عليها أحق به منك. Change your way of your thinking. If this was the case, if this was virtue in you staying single, if someone staying single was a virtue, then Fatima would have preceded everyone else in this, because no one has preceded Fatima in any kind of fadl. إِنَّ لَيْسَ أَحَدٌ يَسْبِقُهَا إِلَى الْفَضْلِ. If this was a good thing, then Fatima al-Zahra, salam Allah alayha, would have been the first of people who didn't get married, but yet she did, emphasizing on the importance of marriage. Now, how about, you know, managing the affairs and things at home and issues like that? Of course, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, Al-mar'atu ra'iyatun ala ahli bayti ba'liha. A wife is someone who manages the affairs of her husband, wa wuldihi, and his children, wa hiya mas'ulatun anhum, and she is responsible for them.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
When it comes to the affairs of her husband, a wife needs to take charge, a wife needs to be responsible, a wife needs to be accountable. لو أمرت أحداً, this is also a very important hadith that shows that level of commitment that a wife needs to have to her husband, that level of obedience that a wife needs to have to her husband. The same way as a husband needs to conform to his wife, obey his wife, make sure that he keeps his wife happy and is the best of company to his wife, the wife also needs to do that same thing. Here the hadith says, لو أمرت أحدا أن يسجد لأحدين. If I was to have commanded someone to prostrate to somebody else, of course in Islam it's prohibited to prostrate to anyone or anything except Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But Rasulullah says, if I was to have commanded anyone to prostrate to anyone, لأمرت المرأة أن تسجد لزوجها. I would have commanded the wife to prostrate to her husband. Clearly this is saying to us that we need to remember the status of a husband. We need to remember that as a wife, you always need to be your best to your husband. other than obedience, loyalty, commitment, understanding, conformity, remembering that there is a greater cause here. Not only you being adamant about your opinion, not only you, for example, you know, receiving some kind of mistreatment from your husband, but being patient over that as well, and remembering that obedience to your husband is obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Serving your husband. Rasulullah says, أَيُّمَا إِمْرَأَةٍ خَدَمَتْ زَوْجَهَا سَبْعَةَ أَيَّامٍ. Any wife who serves her husband for 7 days. And unfortunately, this is the kind of modern day society understanding. When we use the word obey, it's really negative, really bad. Serving, really negative, really bad. But look at the riwayat from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam that speak about how much we need to serve our parents, serve our husband, serve our wife, serve our brothers and fellow brothers and sisters, serve humanity, obey those who are around us, because that's what's going to bring us to the betterment of society. And seeing it in this particular way, there's never going to be dhulm as well. You're never going to mistreat or misuse someone else's kindness, because that would lead to dhulm and oppression. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala ashrafi khalqillahi Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinians have staged a nationwide general strike across the occupied West Bank and in historic Palestine, the lands occupied in 1948, to protest the ongoing Israeli bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip. The strike has led to the suspension of all economic activities and the closure of educational institutions across the occupied West Bank. Shops and private institutions in Palestinian areas in historic Palestine also closed down. Meanwhile, thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in Ramallah to support the strike.
We won't tolerate the continuation of the occupation. It must end. The Israeli regime carries out the ugliest practices against our people wherever they are. And then there are the settlers' ongoing violence. And now there are these airstrikes that are killing children and innocent people.
Protesters from all walks of life and of all ages participated in the rally that headed to the northern entrance of the city, where Israeli military checkpoint and illegal settlement of Beit El are located. The protesters held Palestinian flag and chanted anti-Israeli slogans in solidarity with the resistance in the Gaza Strip.
Today, we are rising against Israel's airstrikes on the Gaza Strip and its general operation against Palestinians here in the West Bank.
We are protesting against the ongoing violence against us, the Palestinians, and also to show support for the resistance in Gaza.
The rally, meanwhile, turned violent, with the Israeli soldiers at the checkpoint firing live ammunition. Palestinians in the occupied territories and historic Palestine have united with a general strike and a day of rage to send in numerous messages. On the top, an expression of anger against this barbaric aggression by the Israeli occupation. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
It was billed as an emergency meeting of EU foreign affairs ministers to discuss the deadly violence in the Middle East. In fact, critics of Israel call it an illegal and merciless bombardment of Palestinians rather than a conflict. The ministers couldn't decide on anything concrete, and so the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, ended up playing the event down.
In an informal meeting, there is no formal conclusions. And what I am going to explain you is my takeaway, my intellectual takeaway from the today meeting.
That takeaway basically consisted of merely calling for peace and for Israel's actions to be proportionate. Rights groups insist what's needed instead is for the EU to slap sanctions on Tel Aviv.
EU, especially if they are true and faithful to their own commitment for human rights protection, there is a time that they have to reflect on these issues. And I think also the pressure coming from civil society is playing a very important role.
But as Palestinians continue to suffer, perhaps Israel's influence in the West is too strong. The White House says the U.S. will continue to provide $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel each year, claiming the regime has a right to defend itself.
The United States cannot continue to act alone and try to impose on all of us, including the European Union, their ideas. They have to engage everyone as we engage in the United Nations.
A large number of EU lawmakers have issued statements condemning Israel's actions. Some of these statements have been strongly worded. They insist Israel is guilty of genocide and ethnic cleansing. The MEPs are calling on the EU to suspend its substantial trade with Israel until such time as Tel Aviv stops breaking international laws. EU legislators are due to hold a number of debates on the crisis this week. The big question is, what difference will they make when it comes to the powers that be? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has concluded his visit to Italy, where he held consultations on the enhancement of mutual cooperation and bilateral ties. On Monday, Iran's top diplomat met with his Italian counterpart, Luigi Di Maio, with whom he talked about political, economic and cultural aspects in view of the historical relations between Iran and Italy. This year marks the 160th anniversary of formal diplomatic relations between the two countries. Issues related to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the ongoing nuclear talks were also on the table.
Italy's position with regard to the nuclear deal is that of waiting to see what might happen. Rome doesn't have an autonomous policy of its own on a number of crucial international issues and is waiting for the US to make a move.
The talks between the two ministers revolved around Italy's posture on the nuclear deal. Years ago, under a Berlusconi government, Rome had the opportunity to play a leading role in the build-up process of the deal, but the role went to Germany in the end. Today, Tehran is assessing whether Italy aims to play a greater role in the revival of the JCPOA.
Also on Monday, Zarif met with the leader of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, who presented him with a gift that, the pontiff said, was a symbol of peace with an olive branch and a dove. The Vatican provided no comment on the content of the talks.
During his trip to Europe, the Iranian foreign minister was expected to visit Austria, where Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are holding talks to find a way to revive the international accord. But the visit was cancelled after Vienna's decision to show solidarity with Israel by flying the regime's flag over government office buildings.
Italy has been quite careless on the Israeli-Palestinian crisis over the past years. Rome once held a position of equal closeness with the parts involved in the conflict, not one of equidistance like it is now. Italy was once very attentive to the needs of the Palestinians, whilst today its stance doesn't help finding a solution to the crisis for which Israel bears grave responsibilities.
On Tuesday, on his final day in Rome, Zarif met with a delegation of lawmakers from the Italian parliament at the Iranian ambassador's residence, Max Civili, Rome.
Free at last. Emerging from the gloom of a four-month COVID-19 lockdown, most Britons are now free to hug, albeit cautiously, visit their pub, sit down to an indoor meal, or visit the cinema. Freedom beckons once more. There is excitement.
I'm happy that I could go to the movies again, you know, because it's just been like you're running out of things to do.
We've just had a lovely lunch, first time in all those months inside a restaurant. It felt good.
But beside the euphoria, there is also anxiety, the emergence of the Indian variant of COVID-19.
I'm told that if it's only marginally more transmissible, we can continue more or less as planned. But if the variant is significantly more transmissible, we're likely to face some hard choices. Thank
you very much, everyone. Perhaps the toughest of those choices, another lockdown. Some scientists, among them the government's chief medical officer, have warned of a summer surge in cases.
All the modelling suggests there is going to be a further surge, and that will find the people who either have not been vaccinated or where the vaccine's not worked.
So far, nearly 70% of Britons over the age of 18 have been offered their first dose of the vaccine, with the government saying the country is in a race between the vaccination program and the virus, especially the new variant first found in India. That's been surging in several areas across England.
So will there be another lockdown? Boris Johnson has called the lockdown roadmap cautious but irreversible. And last month he came under fire for allegedly saying, let the bodies pile on high in their thousands, after reluctantly approving a second England-wide lockdown late last year.
It'd be obviously disappointing, but I would say not entirely unexpected, to be honest.
Steps need to be taken to deal with it. And if that means additional vaccination surges in areas where it exists, or local lockdowns, or nationwide, or travel restrictions, then my belief is that those should be brought in.
The UK's official death toll is nearly 128,000, Europe's highest figure and the world's fifth largest, after the United States, Brazil, India, and Mexico. And the possible outbreak of the Indian variant is sure to upset the Johnson government's roadmap out of lockdown. Saeed Puriza, London.
The families of the victims of the recent deadly attack near a school in Kabul call for proper attention to be paid to those affected by the incident. The families put the casualties at 90 deaths and over 240 wounded, all students. They also called on the international community, the UN and human rights bodies to probe the brutal attack. Referring to repeated targeting of Shia people by terrorist groups in Afghanistan, they also urged the international bodies to officially confirm the systematic genocide of Shia people in the country.
The attack on Sayyid al-Shuhada School came after a series of targeted attacks on Shia religious sites, educational centers, and sports clubs. It's a genocide, and we want the government and international bodies to officially confirm Shia genocide in Afghanistan.
But as observers say, it seems that neither terrorist attacks nor political obstacles can push back the determined young generation of Afghanistan, as they are fully committed to go forward in order to build their own country by relying on knowledge instead of war and violence.
The government has not yet fulfilled its obligation to protect us. The recent attack on innocent schoolgirls was a big tragedy, and such incidents must be stopped in the future. The enemy must know that we will go forward despite the challenges.
It was in the afternoon of May 8 when three back-to-back blasts rocked western Kabul, and many fasting residents of the area witnessed how dozens of schoolgirls were hit by these blasts. Although the Taliban has denied any involvement in the attack, but none of other terrorist groups, including Daesh, has claimed responsibility too.
Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission has emphasized on the need for a practical step from the government. President Ghani has already ordered a thorough probe into the attack and has called on his government to work on a plan to boost the security in Kabul. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thousands of Yemenis headed to the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a to express solidarity with the Palestinians on the Gaza Strip, facing the Israeli relentless lethal bombing campaigns.
The Yemeni people have shown that the issue of Palestine is their red line. They have always voiced their support for the Palestinian cause. The Yemenis believe that Palestine is a sacred land and the occupation must come to an end at any cost. Yemenis crave for jihad in Palestine, even though Yemen is subjected to a brutal war for 7 years now.
Protesters blame the U.S. as complicit in the Israeli war crimes against the women and the children of the besieged Gaza Strip. They urge the Palestinian resistance groups to carry out further retaliatory rocket attacks against Israel.
Yemen's stance has been renewed along with the growing strength of Palestinian resistance in the Gaza. The massive march confirms that the Yemenis stand by our side against the Israeli occupation. We salute the Yemeni people for their steadfast support despite being involved in a deadly war and siege for years.
Yemenis have also lambasted countries, some Arab states, for normalizing their relations with Israel. They said it is a great betrayal to all Muslims around the world.
It is clear that the normalization of relations with Israel is aimed at obtaining the praise of America and Israel. But the aggression happening today against the people of Gaza reveals the extent of their betrayal of the Palestinian cause and all Muslims.
Israel has renewed its attacks on the Gaza Strip and the West Bank in what has become the heaviest war against Palestinians over the past 7 years.
Holding up Palestinian flags, people here voice their solidarity with the Palestinian cause. They say the international community should hold Israel accountable for its war crimes and continued violation of the international law. Yalda Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Started a normalization phase after 3 weeks of lockdown. A 15-day long period of eased but not lifted restrictions has started in the country as daily numbers of new infected started falling. Due to the measures taken during the holy month of Ramadan, the numbers decreased from 60,000 per day to something near 10,000. Turkish president said the country hoped to overcome this pandemic as the new waves across the world has badly affected the situation in Turkey. He also stressed the importance of taking the vaccine to overcome this phase so that Turkey could go back to normal life soon.
Normalleşme adımlarını atıyoruz.
We start implementing our normalization calendar as of Monday. The restrictions will be eased in phases until the end of May and significantly as of June.
Experts say that the gradual normalization would not result in another increase in the numbers of daily infections. They also advise citizens to minimize their home visits to relatives and friends, as well as stay away from shopping malls and crowded areas.
The number of daily infection cases has reached a logical point, paving the way for easing the lockdown. We need to ease the lockdown to make a balance between containing the spread of the virus and allowing our people to go back to work and get prepared to welcome tourists. Our economy has been negatively affected with the lockdowns over the past year. We are trying to continue with the vaccination campaign. The government is now trying to get more vaccine jabs.
Most of the travel restrictions will be lifted, but nighttime and weekend curfews will remain in place, and restaurants will only open for food deliveries. With the new measures, Turkey hopes to compensate the economic losses it sustained over the past year. If tourists don't return to Turkish beaches this year, the nation's current account balance and lira are likely to be hit. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
In a rare show of strength, the opposition parties and the government joined hands in Pakistan's parliament to pass a unanimous resolution or what it said, unending war crimes against unarmed Palestinians by Israel. The parliament called on a 57-member bloc of Muslim countries, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, to now undertake decisive steps to bring an end to ongoing unilateral war against innocent Palestinians. However, not very far from the parliament, the anti-Israeli protesters are not willing to trust OIC, given its track record of failures. The protests in Pakistan are expanding given the relentless bombing by Israel killing Palestinians since last week when Israel imposed unilateral war on Gaza after it attacked the third holiest site of Islam in the occupied eastern Jerusalem.
If their anger is not being expressed by the leadership of the Islamic world, I think they will go on their own. And I believe that an Arab Spring is about to restart. And this Arab Spring is not going to just remain to the Arab boundaries, but it will even come to Pakistan and beyond.
We want action against Israel!
These are Pakistani journalists. They are at pain over a growing scale of violence against international media networks and journalists in occupied Palestine by apartheid state of Israel. They protested and observed Black Day against Israel for killing innocent Palestinians and bombarding commercial infrastructure, housing international media networks, and Palestinian residents. International Federation of Journalists and Political Analysts point out that the frequency of the incidents with which journalists have been attacked with potentially a lethal force in the occupied Palestine indicates about the existence of a formal official policy to silence the media networks and journalists who are struggling hard to document the war crimes of Zionist state. However, so far, Israel has enjoyed impunity from all the war crimes it has committed against the unarmed Palestinian, given the fact it enjoys unconditional support from the U.S. and other NATO allies in the Europe.
It only goes to show that the American moral power and European moral ascendancy also has limits. They are fast losing their moral authority to lecture the world on human rights.
More protests are planned on Friday when the clerics in hundreds of thousands of mosques and Islamic schools are expected to make anti-Israel speeches. Javed Rana, Islamabad. It is the beginning of a series of public protests in Pakistan over no let-up to the atrocities against Palestinians by Israel in the occupied land. Like elsewhere in the Muslim world, people are raging with anger in Pakistan since last week when Israel attacked Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied Al-Quds Sharif and later waged a unilateral war against unarmed Palestinians in Gaza. The Al-Aqsa is the third holiest Islamic site, the desecration of which by Israel has led to the beginning of a renewed wave of public anger against Israel in this part of the world.
Israel!
More protests have been planned to build a public pressure on government to stop ongoing attacks on unarmed Palestinians. Before protests like this one spread across the country, Pakistan has raised the issue in a virtual emergency meeting of Executive Committee of Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, a 50-member bloc of Muslim countries.
There are no words strong enough to condemn the systematic and barbaric crimes against the Palestinians. The deteriorating conditions in the occupied Palestinian territories due to the illegal practices of Israel, the colonial policies, and its continued aggression, siege, and collective punishment are sickening.
However, people attach little hope with the OIC, given its track record of doing little beyond issuing anti-Israel statements. People are particularly angry against the Muslim rulers, including their own, for restricting their official reaction so far to mere customary statements of condemnation, which they say is no longer acceptable to them. They want particularly Pakistan, Turkey, and Iran to undertake concrete measures to prevent of what they call Israeli aggression at a time when many Arab countries have been allegedly siding with the apartheid state.
Hazur Pak sallallahu alaihi wasallam ka irshad hai.
Our Prophet, peace be upon him, said that Muslim nation is just like the one body. If one part of it gets injured, the other part would feel its pain. Israel is committing atrocities on our children, brothers and sisters. It is obvious that we feel its pain. Our hearts beat with our Palestinian brothers. Pakistan and other Muslim countries now must declare a jihad against Israel.
The latest round of Israel's unilateral attacks started after Palestinians resisted the forcible eviction from their homes in the eastern Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Since then, Israel has killed scores of Palestinians, including women and children, and injured many others. The housing and commercial infrastructure, including offices of international media houses in Gaza, have also been bombarded to silence the reporting of events from the occupied land. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Hundreds of Austrian protesters gather outside the office of Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, expressing their anger at the government's decision to take Israel's side as it continues its deadly bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip.
Protesters were not given legal permission for a large demonstration, but they did gather outside the Chancellery, expressing outrage at the fact that the Israeli flag has been hoisted on top of this building.
Organizers said that by raising its flag and expressing solidarity with Israel, the government has violated Austria's constitution.
Our main protest is we want this flag to be down because this flag is against our constitution. Our constitution stipulates neutrality, and our government takes side with a war party, with a party which violates systematically the rights of other people, of the Palestinians. They evict them, they ethnically cleanse them, they take their land.
Political commentators say Austria's one-sided political position runs contrary to the country's traditional policies founded on democracy.
This is unbelievable, and I'm sure that many of the Austrian people, because nobody was asked about this, this was a coup d'etat, this with the flag. And I'm sure that many of the Austrian people don't accept this. I'm here because we are siding the Palestinians, we are fighting their rights, but we are also protecting our rights as Austrian, as European Democrats.
We want the Palestinian people to know, and we want the Israeli government and the Austrian government to know that we will not be quiet, that we cannot be quiet down, and that the Palestinian people have a right on their land, and they have to stop this colonial expansion now.
Activists say they will continue their attempts to pile public pressure on the government and are calling on authorities to give them back their right to demonstrate. Homalezki, Vienna.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Talk about some of the laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning